this is the closest thing to a basic income that's existed for any significant period of time anywhere in the world.
As lawmakers consider cuts, a look at the impact of the PFD. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the House Finance Committee passes its version of the budget.
I can tell you, look you straight in the eye, that everybody who's walked into my office was told, no, we don't have the money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
It's PFD application time in Alaska. The deadline is March 31st, and if nothing changes, this year's check will be about the same size as last year's, totaling more than $2,000. But of course, it's possible something will change. As lawmakers grapple with a mammoth budget deficit, it's likely the solution will include using permanent fund earnings and reducing the dividend. What could that mean for Alaskans and the economy? APRN's Rachel Waldholtz went to find out.
One interesting thing about this debate is that Alaska might scale back the PFD, just as the rest of the world is warming to the idea.
This is the closest thing to a basic income that's existed for any significant period of time anywhere in the world.
That's Carl Weiderquist, a professor of political philosophy at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service in Qatar, and a supporter of a universal basic income, which is pretty much what it sounds like, a guaranteed minimum payment distributed to all citizens. The idea is having a moment. There's an upcoming referendum in Switzerland, pilot projects planned for Finland, the Netherlands, and Canada, and increasing interest from Silicon Valley, which worries that the automation revolution, like self-driving cars, will soon put a whole lot of people out of work. Weiderquist says all of these places can learn from Alaska.
There are a lot of people talking about it, but only Alaska has done it, and Alaska's been doing it for over 30 years.
So what do we know after 3.5 decades? Well, that's a little hard to say.
There's an awful lot that we don't know.
Gunnar Knapp runs the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. He says there's never been much research on the dividend, and most Alaskans probably don't even know exactly how they spend it.
You may think, oh, I use that $1,000 to buy this plane ticket. But suppose you were going to buy that plane ticket anyway, then really what that $1,000 maybe went to is just sort of all the regular stuff that you buy, except you actually bought a little bit more of it.
But Knapp says some things are clear. For one, the dividend matters a lot more if you're poor than if you're rich. For the 20% of Alaska households whose incomes average $35,000 a year or less, the PFD is a major chunk of change. For a family of four, last year's checks added up to more than $8,000. And Knapp says that's one reason Alaska has one of the most equal, or least unequal, distributions of wealth in the U.S.
There's many other things that enter into income equality, but certainly we know that the dividend is a contributing factor.
In general, Knapp says the dividend also has a bigger impact in rural Alaska than the Rail Belt. Cuts would hit hardest in regions with the lowest median household income. That includes some parts of Fairbanks and Anchorage, plus a wide swath of western Alaska. Standing outside the AC grocery store in Bethel, you find plenty of people who put their PFD in a savings account, like 36-year-old Damian Jones. He's actually in town from Anchorage.
That's the best way to save it, you know, just put it in savings, let it accumulate, and when a rough time come, you use it.
Jones says he'd be okay if the PFD is cut, but he worries about others in the region, who are dealing with both a high cost of living and high unemployment. For many people, especially in the villages, the PFD is a crucial cash infusion. Marie Andrew is in town from Tuluksak. She spent her 2015 PFD on a 1995 Ford Explorer. But usually, she says, it just goes to bills. Cutting it would be a big deal.
It'll affect me a lot. I wouldn't be able to pay my lights or buy food.
26-year-old Peter Udakhyuk Jr. is from Scammon Bay. He had his 2-year-old son, Simon, on his hip and says his last PFD went to diapers, wipes, and food.
It all goes to him. And his PFD goes to his savings for his college or some things he needs in the future.
This is really an extremely important part of the PFD.
That's Gunnar Knapp again. He says one thing the PFD does is make it possible to build wealth.
For lower-income people who really need to use most of their paycheck just to get by, it provides a way to accumulate and save money over time.
Which can then go towards college or a down payment on a house or to start a business. And that's actually true for folks up and down the income ladder. But what about everyone who spent their PFD on a new laptop or Christmas presents or a snow machine? They aren't just making October an Alaska retailer's favorite time of year. That money is rippling through the economy. In an analysis presented to lawmakers, Knapp estimates that cutting the PFD in half could cost more than 6,000 jobs statewide and pull about $1 billion of income out of the economy. Lawmakers must weigh those effects against the impacts of other options, like cutting government services, instituting an income tax, or raising oil taxes. Or, most likely, some combination of them all. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholtz in Anchorage.
The House Finance Committee sent its budget proposal to the House floor today, including some late changes. The budget would cut spending by $280 million. It also spends $225 million in funds left from the current budget. There were some intense exchanges between committee members before the final vote. Wasilla Republican Representative Lynn Gaddis questioned why the leftover funds from the current budget only emerged recently.
Folks in my district are saying, why in the heck would I trust you to go and tax me or take my permanent fund dividend when you guys are playing these shell games?
But Eagle River Republican Representative Dan Sadler said spending the savings is a legitimate budget strategy. Yesterday, the committee added $30 million for an addiction treatment program and restored $2.7 million for public broadcasting and $1.7 million for the Nome Youth Facility. But it didn't vote to restore $25 million for the University of Alaska. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says the budget shortchanged vulnerable Alaskans. He noted the spending plan cuts all state funding for pre-kindergarten.
I understand we have to cut waste, but we don't have to cut the things that make a difference in people's lives. That's where I draw the line.
But committee co-chairman Mark Newman says as the state considers cutting permanent fund dividends and raising taxes, it must cut spending.
I've had to tell every group, every person that's walked into my office, that has approached me on the street, wherever they talk to me, no. I can tell you, look you straight in the eye, that everybody who's walked into my office was told, no, we don't have the money.
The House is scheduled to discuss the budget and potentially vote on it tomorrow. The Senate may vote on its version of the budget on Saturday. Then the two houses will work to resolve the differences. Senators are working on a bill that would overhaul Alaska's criminal justice system. The measure would reduce arrests and prison time for nonviolent offenses. It also would help prisoners re-enter society. The bill has a lot of bipartisan support, but victims' rights advocates and some legislators have raised concerns about the legislation. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The bill draws on recommendations from the 13-member Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. It spent more than a year considering ways to reduce recidivism and take pressure off of the need to build more prisons. North Pole Republican Senator John Coghill sponsored the bill. He says the legislation would reduce the state's prison population by 21% over the next 10 years, saving the state more than $400 million. Coghill also has worked to include input from victims' rights advocates, who are worried that the reforms would benefit offenders at victims' expense. Emily Haynes testified in Juneau that a man who sexually assaulted her could be released soon due to the bill. That's because he accepted a plea bargain that reduced the severity of his conviction.
I oppose this bill. It's going to have a direct impact on my life. 5 years ago, I was a victim of a violent sexual assault, and the offender will be eligible for release immediately under your proposal. For the past 5 years, I've been fighting this case.
And Butch Moore of Anchorage asked that the bill require those convicted of murder to have minimum sentences at least as long as those convicted of rapes. His daughter was killed in 2014. The bill prevents those convicted of sex crimes and domestic violence offenses from being released early. Chugiak Republican Senator Bill Stoltz supported more changes to the bill at a recent hearing. While the commission included a police officer and heard testimony from victims' rights advocates and corrections officers, Stoltz says law enforcement and victims didn't have enough input on the legislation. He chairs the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Well, I think the rights of victims have been improved. I don't think they were really that well considered through the commission process. I think they were invited, but not that welcome there. And the Office of Victims' Rights, which has very in-depth expertise, really didn't get meaningful input until the bill got to this committee.
The Senate State Affairs Committee amended the bill to require the Department of Corrections to notify victims of offenders who are eligible for release under the bill. The committee also made a series of amendments and votes to advance the bill. Supporters of the legislation have credited the Pew Charitable Trusts with providing much of the research and national expertise that supported the commission's work. But Stoltz says the nonprofit foundation has had too much influence over the bill.
I haven't fallen under the talismanic influences of the Pew Charitable Trust. I am interested in the fiscal savings, but I think the public has not been well enough informed of the details of that crime bill.
But supporters of reform are concerned that some of the changes are weakening the bill. Grace Singh, assistant to the president at the Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, criticizes a provision that requires that those who've had their conviction suspended still have their charges listed on the CourtView website.
This significantly discourages self-sufficiency, and it puts them in a more desperate position, which will not discourage crime or recidivism rates.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will hear the bill next. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, many mushers are taking their 24-hour layovers on the Iditarod Trail.
It just works out just about right here. They aren't too tired, but they'll make good use of the rest.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The battle to keep the 425 Brigade combat team at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson may seem all but won. The top uniformed officer of the Army, General Mark Milley, said at a hearing last month he hopes to postpone the troop cut for at least a year, citing national security interests. But Senator Dan Sullivan says it's not a done deal yet. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Sullivan is still talking about the value of the 425 at hearings of the Senate Armed Services Committee to build support.
We've been working this issue for well over a year now. But now we're not working against the Army, we're working with the Army.
These days he's pressing the area commanders, the generals in charge of U.S. forces in Europe and the Middle East, and the admiral responsible for the Pacific.
In all of those hearings, I asked them, hey, General Milley is now reversing this decision. Do you support that? And importantly, and we can get you the testimony, every single one of the combatant commanders who are important to the 425 said yes, they support it strongly.
But the decision is up to the Secretary of the Army. Right now, there's an acting secretary who seemed willing to defer to General Milley's view. It's not clear, though, whether he'll be the one to make the call. Sullivan, in an interview last week, said he's also working on Eric Fanning, the man nominated to be the Army's next civilian boss.
Secretary of the Army designee, Mr. Fanning. I have a phone call with him today to kind of finalize a couple commitments that he and I have talked about with regard to the 425.
Sullivan said he placed a hold on Fanning's confirmation, blocking him from getting a Senate vote.
I intend to release that hold.
At least one other senator put a hold on Fanning, though, for unrelated reasons. Sullivan has also been a general critic of the plan to cut 40,000 soldiers to bring the army down to 450,000 troops. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Dallas Seavey has pushed his team at the front of Iditarod Pack into the former gold mining settlement of Cripple. 400 miles into the race, the three-time champion is joined by seven others out of Ophir, including Jeff King, Norwegian Robert Sorley, and Noah Burmeister. The next 2 days, we'll see a shakeup in the standings as mushers leapfrog one another upon completing their 24-hour breaks in different checkpoints. In the traditionally popular stop of Takotna, Ellie Zirkel, Pete Kaiser, and Mitch Seavey have been resting and are eligible to leave late tonight. Seavey is a regular in Takotna and says there are plenty of reasons for that.
It just works out just about right here. They aren't too tired, but they'll make good use of the rest. And the amenities here are great, and especially the hot water available to feed your dogs. It's really important.
The long break gives mushers the chance to spend a little more time examining and caring for their dogs in ways that aren't possible during short 3 or 4 hour rests. For Jody Bailey, that's time spent refueling and recalibrating her team.
The dogs will get 4 big feedings while they're here. They'll get snacks. This has been, the trail conditions are such that the feet are taking a little bit of a toll on the feet, so I've actually gone through the team twice and massaged the feet with a really nice liniment massage oil.
Bailey says the snow is rough for those running in the middle of the pack because it's getting ground down to the consistency of sugar, which is hard on paws. Many mushers pick Takotna for their 24 because the hospitality extends beyond hearty food and an abundant selection of pies. Signs warn tourists and media away from resting teams. Though in spite of the amenities, Norwegian race rookie Lars Munson is set up in a tent next to his sled and dogs, which is how he likes it.
Total calmness and privacy. You know, I'm totally alone. That's much better.
Hans got scratched from the race this morning. He's the fourth musher to pull out of the 2016 Iditarod. For much more on all things Iditarod, including our video series Mushing Explained, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. Today's video delves into sled dog genetics and compares Alaskan Huskies to, yes, wide receivers in the NFL.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
More than 1,000 scientists and policymakers from around the world, along with organizations representing indigenous peoples, industry, and other interests, are converging in Fairbanks for Arctic Science Summit Week. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The first of dozens of events to be held as part of the 18th annual Arctic Science Summit Week gets underway today on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. UAF Vice Chancellor for Research Larry Hinsman says this year's summit is the first to be held on U.S. soil, and it'll be the biggest yet.
You typically have like just 5 or 6 groups getting together. And so what we've done this time is essentially we're inviting almost every group that facilitates Arctic research to join us for this meeting.
Hinsman says organizers decided to expand the summit's invitation list this year to enable face-to-face communication among participants, especially those working in research related to climate change. He says there's also a practical reason for a bigger summit: to hold down costs.
It's really expensive and it's really difficult to work in the Arctic and accomplish very much. And what we found is that if we can collaborate, if we can cooperate and share our resources and share our understanding and share our data, then we can achieve so much more.
The scientists will give presentations in several forums that in previous years have been held separately, including the Arctic Observing Summit. UAF International Arctic Research Center Director Hayo Eiken is the organizer of that three-day event.
We have a great mix of not just researchers, but also different stakeholders, different experts.
Eiken says those stakeholders include industry and the original Arctic observers, who will offer traditional knowledge to complement the scientific perspective.
We're going to be bringing in a lot of people from tribal government, indigenous peoples organizations around the Arctic to talk specifically about how can we best make observations jointly to allow us to better understand and respond to these rapid changes that we're seeing in the Arctic.
A group of diplomats that help nations shape their responses to those changes also will be meeting at UAF next week. They're the Senior Arctic Officials, or SAOs, a group that carries out the day-to-day work of the Arctic Council, the advisory organization representing the eight circumpolar nations. Some of the SAO presentations will be open to the public, and they'll offer an insight into their nation's perspectives on the Arctic, says Nils Andreasen, the secretariat of the Alaska Arctic Council Host Committee, which is coordinating the SAO visit.
It's a great place to explore the intersection between science, policy, business, and community interests.
Andreasen, who's also executive director of Anchorage-based Institute of the North, says Monday's Fairbanks Greater Chamber of Commerce meeting at the Carlson Center will offer a great opportunity to learn more about the Arctic Council and the SAOs. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Some Southeast Alaska families have stayed with the tradition of helping their loved ones age in place. They live at home with children and grandchildren instead of moving into a nursing home. It's a friendlier and lower cost option for older residents of the region whose numbers are growing faster than the state as a whole. As part of Coast Alaska's Aging Southeast series, KFSK's Angela Denning tells us about one Petersburg family with four generations living under the same roof.
I'm Elizabeth R. Tyner. I'm 91 years old. I'll be 92 in a week or so.
Elizabeth Tyner sits at the kitchen table in a red striped shirt, blue jeans, and blue Crocs sandals. Her short white hair curled, her hands clasp a tissue because she has a cold. She readily talks about her life. Over the decades, she's sold auto parts and worked at a thermometer factory.
What it was doing was putting the ink in there, it really wasn't ink, it was mercury. You shook the stuff down where it went up and down in there so you could tell the temperature. It was real interesting, it really was.
Her granddaughter, Melinda Cook, is ready to fill in the details. When Tyner first moved to Petersburg in 2011, she lived in independent housing for seniors. She shared a two-bedroom apartment with a friend for $1,400 a month. Cook says that worked well for several years until one day her grandmother fell.
She didn't pull the alarm. She laid on the floor for 4 hours.
Tyner eventually called the family, which contacted 911. There were other signs that decision-making was becoming difficult. But switching to assisted living, including daily food service and as-needed care, would have cost about $6,000 a month. So Tyner moved in with her family and now pays $500 a month for three caregivers 5 days a week.
Just making sure she's drinking water, getting meals, because that we started finding that that was necessary.
For Cook, having Tyner at home is the right thing to do. Her family has taken care of their elderly for generations.
I mean, we all kind of have our assignments in this generation. My cousins have their parents, and I mean, literally, every one of us in my generation has an elder living with them at this time.
Like most of Southeast, Petersburg's population is aging faster than Alaska as a whole. A recent borough study shows that in about 15 years, seniors will double to 28% of the town's population. In the village of Cake, on the next island over, there are 80 to 90 elders out of a population of about 600. Most are Alaska Native. Families take care of their elders at home until they need medical help and have to go off-island. Many families rely on in-home caregivers.
I think living at home is what they want the most. They don't want to leave their homes and go to assisted living places.
Juanita James is the site manager and cook at Cakes Senior Center, which provides lunch and rides around town.
They'd rather have their loved ones close by that don't have much more time to live. And their relatives are used to making their cultural food for them and taking them to, like when they're having Indian dance or something.
They thrive better at home.
Keith Smith works for Southeast Alaska's Independent Living's Ketchikan office.
And I think that people live longer, their mind stays healthier when they are able to stay in the midst of their life like that.
SAIL is a nonprofit resource center that helps seniors and people with disabilities live at home and maintain independence. It has offices in Southeast's larger communities and also serves more remote towns. SAIL helps clients problem solve.
One of the gentlemen I'm working with is just like overwhelmingly happy when he discovered the device that from 3 feet away you can clip your own toenails. That is huge for him.
For Cook's family, it meant moving to a house with an open floor plan and remodeling a bathroom. Although Tyner is mobile right now, there's plenty of room for a walker or wheelchair if it's ever needed.
How are you? How did it go?
It went good. I was the only one who showed up.
That's good. That shows you're this.
Cook's 18-year-old daughter, Shawnee, arrives home from an evening workshop at school on financial aid for college. The teen's one-year-old is already asleep. Shawnee says it's great her son can live with his great-great-grandmother.
He knows that she's the person to go to when he wants something to eat.
He'll crawl up to you for food if he wants it.
He will. I'm trying to teach him a little bit about dancing. I've got him shaking his shoulders, you know, and moving his butt and going up and down, you know. And
also sharing space is Cook's partner and her two sons, ages 14 and 20. It's not always easy. Tyner's dementia crops up every now and again, like the time she accused one of her great-grandsons of taking a box of hers. But at least for now, the family agrees it's better for everyone to be sharing life under the same roof. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Ben Matheson in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Tocotna, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and artisan groceries, including Alaskan products, across Alaska. Learn about year-round delivery options at fullcircle.com/APRN.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.